regular and supplemental meetings are called to order. I'd like to go ahead and reset the supplemental meeting, and then the first thing we'd like to do is have a moment of silence for those who are part of the system that aren't with us anymore. Thank you. Now we move to the meeting minutes for the June 8th meeting. Do we have any questions or comments on those? All right, if not, can we have a motion to approve?
So moved.
Second.
All in favor? Any opposed? Motion carries. Detailed consent agenda. Kelly, anything you want to flag?
No, there's nothing unusual. Thank you.
There are a lot more refunds this month than normal.
There are a lot of refunds this month, and you'll see that again next month. And we don't know why. The only thing we can think of is maybe there was a delay with the cyber issues they were having over at the city, but we don't know why they increase at this time.
And these are people retiring that want the refunds of their contribution?
It's really very unusual that they would take a refund after they've been here for more than 5 years. So these are people that oftentimes start the academy and then leave at some point in the academy or within their first, 2 to 3 years.
Okay, great. So we have a motion to approve the consent agenda. Second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed?
Aye.
Motion carries. It doesn't look like we have anyone here physically, but do we have anyone online who'd like to make a public comment?
So press 5-star. I can unmute them.
Okay. All right, let's go ahead and move to item C1. Brian. Private asset, cash flow, projection, update.
Thank you, Nick.
Validated by Ryan. It's going to be exactly what he says it's going to be.
Exactly. Exciting to bat lead off today. This is a quarterly review we do on the private market portfolio. I think it'll lead well to some slides in looking forward on the private markets program, so I think it'll lead well into the consultant discussion. So, usual disclaimer, we don't have a whole lot of control over cash flows and none in private equity. So all these projections are based on our best estimates and built out over a two-year period, asset by asset. So we ended the quarter with $544 million in private market assets. For the newer board members, at $1.4 billion in private market distributions. That's since we started the secondary sale process in 2016. This is the benefit coverage chart. The green bars are showing the annual net benefit outflows. Blue is annual net private asset inflows. So you can see it kind of varies. The green bar is very steady, but over the last 5 years, we've covered 114% of benefit outflows with private market inflows. And then one thing to think about is that equation is going to flip going forward as we liquidate what's remaining in the private market portfolio. We're going to be in a situation where we are needing to come up with a source for the $100 million a year in outflows plus potential capital calls into the private markets portfolio. Quarterly activity in Q2, two small capital calls in the infrastructure Aero Fund and the Industry Ventures Venture Capital Fund. On distributions, we had kind of similar story to Q1, where most of the distributions are coming from the AEW portfolio. You can see we have the final cash distribution out of Museum Tower, so that asset is now closed. That was just kind of cash that was remaining on the balance sheet for the last year. About $16 million in distributions in Q2.
Hey, Ryan, can I ask a question about Museum Tower?
Mm-hmm.
It says final distribution here. Do we have kind of a percentage of amount of money we made, if any, from the time we invested in that, paid money out?
I don't know the exact number. It's slightly positive from inception.
Okay.
You know, it's like it's a big number we put in and a big number we got out, and it's, maybe a positive one and a half IRR.
It's always funny that that's the poster child for.
I was on that committee.
And I always say, you know, I think we made a little bit of money.
We made a little bit of money.
Let me redirect you to other things.
Yeah.
Yeah. Brian, go back to slide five. And I know that I'm a repeater on this, but I want to. I will always be a repeater. I really can't stress how this 114% from private inflows covering our net benefit outflows. What a outlier that is, and what a burden on the staff versus, say, other peer pension funds. They just don't have to, they didn't have to live with this sort of overhang, and yet this team produced all the cash flow to pay the shortage for the last couple of years, doing things that aren't traditional tasks and responsibilities. It might be a fringe part of it, but it's not the core. And so when I look back over the last couple of years since I've been involved, and I'm thinking of what are tangible things the team, the staff has done, to me this is as much a poster child for everything. And the fact that everyone was slightly mad at Kelly, which meant she was doing a great job back way back when as well. So I really I just can't tout this as a tangible marker, signpost, scoreboard of what staff has done in the last couple of years, and just what would have happened, what we would have had to do had this not been occurring. And yes, you don't control all of it, but the fact that from day one there was oversight, there was pressure, there was management, there were judgments, there were, you know, some involved legal, I mean, just it was a whole bunch of things, and that's the way things get done. So this is a big deal, in my view.
As an annuitant, I thank you.
Right. Okay. Yeah, and the money coming back in the last year, plus the safety reserve, has allowed us to reinvest $80-plus million into the equity portfolio and down markets. So worked well. So this is showing quarterly activity going back 7 years now. I would just say if you look at the recent trends, kind of been ebbing and flowing. We've talked about it. It's going to be lumpy going forward. It's going to be even more lumpy with a lot of the remaining assets very concentrated into two holdings. This is looking at the forward projections through the end of 24. Hopefully we get through 24 and we don't have to add a year on 25. And there's a few things left, but the big piece is remaining. We're projecting, I guess, the bulk of the proceeds the rest of this year are coming out of the Lone Star funds and the Maritime Shipping Fund from J.P. Morgan. And then what's driving proceeds in 2024 is the Huff Energy Fund, and the bulk of the AEW remaining assets are projected to come back in 2024.
Is there any new developments on either of those at this stage in the last month?
Progress on the Lone Star sales in that portfolio. We'll have more clarity on bids at the end of the month. I have a call with them, I think, the last week of July, and then we'll talk to the banker as well. So,
what's the first hurdle for them? For
that? Yeah, we don't want to talk.
Okay.
Yeah. Sorry, but then close session. Give me a call, Michael.
I never know what.
Yeah, we were dancing on this subject. So, legacy assets. This is showing kind of remaining private market proceeds, and then what share of them are legacy, and legacy is everything we've defined as more hair on them, harder to liquidate. So, mainly the stuff we, you know, Lone Star, Huff, AEW, it's in that category. And you can see the bulk of it reducing in 24, and that's because Huff Energy is such a large value, and that's when we're projecting the sale to occur. So this is showing our allocation to private market assets and our projections going forward. I'll point out at one point in 2016, we were at 62/3 of the portfolio in privates. We're down to 28%. Obviously, it's dependent on a few large asset sales, but we're projecting at some point in 2024 we would get below our long-term target, which is 15%. So these are the additional slides that I think add context to what we're about to discuss with the consultant.
If I have to say one more thing.
Yeah.
I think everyone should put themselves into the shoes of you're sitting here a year from now, given all the history, and our roadmap says that we're now at or about to be under allocated in private assets. What would you want to know what level of confidence more than you have right now would you want to gain to go ahead in an open session, approve a private capital investment. You know, Armando, you and Kent, you'd have, you know, the people that you represent calling you saying, like, you guys made another private investment? Isn't that what, you know, and I know we should in the future because you stick with the allocation and, you know, you deviate a little bit, but that's the thing that works. But I think we really, as we think about the consultant and, you know, whatever role they play, whoever it is, we need to really think about a year downrange from now, we're sitting here, and do we get enough, you know, there's a recommendation to hire secondary private equity fund, and, you know, it's a 5 to 7 year, you know, Michael can tell us, you know, what all the liquidity, illiquidity constraints there are, and that we should be thinking as we think about this next decision on the consultant. It's not the main part of it, but it is part of it. What would I want to know? What confidence level do I want to have in order to make an affirmative decision a year from now?
But that's got to be a clinical, unemotional, forward-looking decision, right? Because
sure,
as a part of the asset allocation, we need a lot of time, we need a lot of luck, but those decisions can help, right, gap the underfunding nature, and the returns, if we pick the right partners, are going to be outsized and above public market returns. But I understand what you're saying, but I think you just have to be clinical and unemotional about that.
And I think the only thing I would add to that is I think having a top advisor in that process, which was clearly lacking before, is a huge benefit that they didn't either follow or didn't have before, that got them in the trouble before.
I think so, they were a top-paid consultant back then. They were the top.
The other thing is, I think, everything we've talked about with consultants, the approach this time will be very different. It won't be as concentrated. It'll be with more diversified
structures.
So the structure is going to be very, very different, and we're not going to have we shouldn't have any concentrated risk to the extent that we did in the past. So I think that's an important factor that would need to be considered at that point.
Yeah. I think, Nick, your points are totally spot on, but I think there's a lot of general partnerships that would be proud to have Dallas Police and Fire as their limited partners. We just have to find those people.
All right, so going forward, we have not made a private market commitment since 2016. Long-term targets in the asset allocation are 50% total targets to private markets, which is 5% to real estate, 5% to natural resources, which is the ag portfolio, and 5% to private equity. So what we're talking about is about $100 million each to those asset classes. We're currently overweight. We already covered that maybe some point in 2024 we're back to target or underweight. Before we're making any new investments in the consultant decisions, kind of first in this process, we also need to consider quite a few planning items. When to start reinvestment? Do we start when we're below 5 in an asset class or below 15 total? Governance and diligence process and approval process will look a lot different than it does for public market assets. So, what does that look like? How do we move through that process? Annual pacing plans to kind of figure out what the commitment size is and how many funds per year we want to be doing. And then we need to look at the private market provisions and the investment policy statement and make some updates there.
Right. The 5, 5, and 5 to private, is that something that we just came up on our own? Is that something we've been advised before? Is that pretty
key that was involved?
Yeah. That was a 2018 update to the asset allocation. I think there was thought put into that, but it was also we are so over-allocated, we know we're not doing anything over the near term, so let's just set kind of a flag in the ground in the future to work towards, and then once we get closer, which we're getting closer to, we'll figure out exactly what we want to do in those spaces.
Yes.
Reminder, any new alternative investment, which would be private markets, would require a vote of 8 trustees to approve, so that's, you know, something we'll need to consider is, you know, timing of what's in the market and how we work through the IAC and the approval process. So this is looking at private market holdings at the end of the quarter. The thing I want to point out here is just how concentrated the remaining holdings are. So Huff, Lone Star, and AEW alone, those three are above the 15% target. And 90% of what we plan to sell is in these three assets. So until something happens there, there's nothing we can do new on the private side. So we talked to the IC about initial thoughts by asset class, and we've been talking to some of the consultants about it as we've worked through the RFP process, and we brought it to the board, I think, in November. But private equity, we've been talking about considering a secondary fund commitment to gain some vintage-year diversification and mitigate JACER out of the program. So that's some likely the first commitment or so in that space would be in a secondary fund, or we'll consider that strongly. Investments in the initial years of the program will likely be with larger established managers, given our history. We need to think about what exposures we want within private equity, growth, buyout, private debt, middle market. Kind of first step once we're really reinvesting in the program will be the pacing and commitment plan. We think it kind of looks like 3 to 4 commitments of around $10 million per year to get to that $100 million target, depending on how big and what you do on the secondary side. And then we've talked a few times about private debt, private credit is a very hot area right now. We don't have it in asset allocation. Do we want to include that? Do we want to include it down the road? It likely is a further down the road item, but we'll look. We plan to reopen asset allocation with Nikita this summer, so we'll look at kind of our targets and consider if that 15% is right and what areas of private markets we want to be in. On the real estate side, given the size, we are very unlikely to ever do individual properties or direct real estate in this portfolio. So I think there's some component that's a majority or half of the portfolio or a little bit more in a core exposure, and then maybe some opportunistic or sector funds around that. And then in ag, just a reminder, we have the manual life ag portfolio that we plan to keep. There could be some changes within that, but we're not looking initially at new investment in ag. So, any question on plans or expectations for the portfolio?
Have you seen much recently in, like, the distressed that area?
In ag or?
No, just general distressed that. Not really.
No, we've met with some managers, but, you know, we've been out of the market for so long. And, you know, I know there's some dry powder funds that people raise looking for the right time to deploy, and I think those are, you know, starting to deploy. Any other questions? Okay, we will move forward to the consultant item then. So, start with the process and what we've done to date on it. So we issued an RFP to 9 firms in February of this year. Once we got the RFPs back, we went through them, we eliminated 4 firms, and staff held in-person interviews with 5 firms. 2 specialty and 3 full-service consultants. We met with the subcommittee of the board and IAC, which was 6 members, in May, and at that meeting we made the decision to move forward with the assumption that Makita would remain the general consultant, and then we're going to look at what we want to do on the private market side. Makita was going to be approved, re-approved as a general, no matter what we do today. So we had interviews with Makita and Allborn on June 15th with the subcommittee, and now we're bringing it to the board to make a decision.
Who's on the go over? Who's on the committee?
Okay, Nancy, Tina, Ken from the board, and then Tom, Rakesh, and Ryan Bailey from the IAC. So 3 board, 3 IAC members. This is shown in timeline form. Okay, so I think the key considerations for us and for the board on what to do with the consultant in private markets should be, first, their capabilities in private markets. What are they doing? And we can't just consider this in a vacuum. We need to think about it in terms of what our plans for the portfolio are, what we're going to be investing in. I think the board needs to weigh the trade-offs of one consultant advising on everything versus adding a specialty consultant to cover private market assets classes. And then last, there's the fees that we'd be paying for these services. We've given you guys a detailed fee breakdown in the handouts at your table.
The cost difference over a five-year period would be about $115,000 per year more for Allhorn than Makita. A few other caveats on the fees. Makita, they have the benefit of being the general consultant, so they would not start charging us fees to private markets until we're making our first primary commitment. So we would get through a lot of the planning items, pacing plans. If we did a secondary, we would not be charged for that. And then once we're making primary private equity or real estate commitments, that's when the fee would start. With Allhorn, since we're not currently contracted with them, the fees would start when we start doing the pacing plan. So that could be, you know, 6 months, year, depending on kind of timing difference on when we start paying the fees for private markets. If we add private credit down the road, which I think is maybe year three item that we're actually investing in that space, if we add it, that would be an additional fee from Allhorn. Makita's fee covers kind of all the private market asset classes. So this is a comparison of the two firms. I think the main thing to focus on here is I think this shows well kind of the depth and breadth of what Allhorn does versus Makita. You can see they advise on about $400 billion of private markets. Makita, $117 billion. Would say among kind of full service general consultants, Makita has some of the most in depth coverage of a full service general consultant. If you look at ownership, it looks pretty similar. Allhorn's ownership is a little bit more concentrated amongst the large shareholder, but other than that, it looks fairly similar. Allhorn does 100% non-discretionary, so they don't have any portfolios that they directly manage in-house, where Makita has some discretionary clients. And then I think if you look at expected capital to be underwritten deployed, and then the number of funds underwritten a year, 150 for Makita versus 600 for Allhorn, kind of all these numbers about four times more coverage for Allhorn versus Makita. Moving forward, 34 of diligence. Instead of doing pros and cons, we kind of give them just pros for each firm. And I'm going to start on the right-hand side of the page with Allhorn. Obviously, we just went over it, but the depth of their coverage. They have a very comprehensive online platform that, you know, they put all their research on. They have a very robust operational due diligence process. When we had the call with them, they had people from that team on the phone, so they really focus on ODD. And then talking to the subcommittee and IC members that have worked with them in the past, they had very positive things to say about Allhorn. On Makita, I think the benefit of one consultant versus two, they understand DPFE, they understand our portfolio, they understand the liquidity situation that we're in and some of the governance around DPFE. Over the last 5 years, we've built a good working relationship with Makita. We have a lot of trust in them. As I said before, they have very strong capabilities for full-service consultants. They have, I think, 20-ish clients that just use Makita for private markets, and they don't even use as Makita as a general. So I think that shows kind of they are able to do both, and then the cost savings. One other difference to point out is in the contract, and there's a handout on your table that outlines it, but that may affect your decision. So provided details, if you want to talk about that issue, we would need to go into closed session to cover that.
Ryan, it's not lost on me that you did one blue, one red, so it's kind of like the country split 50-50.
It was, but
you're mirroring it on.
You always do red and blue.
On this. Okay. All right. Well, it could be UT.
We don't know the political, you know.
Burn orange and maroon. Could have done that.
All we're doing is they're not political, so.
What, Al, are you talking about the first thing on fiduciary liability? What? You're saying they disclaim indirect.
So if we talk about that, we need to go to the closed session.
We can talk about that in closed session if you want to.
Okay. I mean, I think it's an important part of what we need.
One thing that I would like to just remind you of is because we're in Texas with open meeting laws, we have to have this conversation in open session, which is, you know, a little bit awkward when you're picking a consultant like this. So just be cognizant of your what you choose to say and not because there's people listening on the phone, they might listen to the tape later, including the press, and maybe one of these two companies. I just wanted to remind you of that.
Thank you, Kelly. I forgot to say that at the outset.
Ryan, do you have anything else to kind of that?
No. If we want to go into closed session to talk about the legal item, we can do that, and then we wanted to first get feedback from
you. Yeah, that's what – are you ready now
yeah.
for us to go? Okay. I think Tina texted she's online and didn't want to get her voice lost. So, Tina, do you want to comment on this?
Yes, especially being part of the investment consulting committee previously and then this time. This was an interesting decision this year. The decision to choose an investment consultant was not easy, and it's clear because I think we were supposed to have a decision at this board meeting. With that said, I've been completely transparent during that committee meeting that I had a preferential treatment for Makita. They've proven to be great partners, effective. Our current successes have been, they're part of that. Leo and Aaron have been present at all meetings, and I do think that Makita would be, if chosen, a good choice. With Alburn, it was quickly assessed that they were too big, too robust, too expensive, and not familiar with our investment policies, with our illiquidity issues from the past. And then the analogies that were given with Alborn was like, why shoot, why kill a mosquito with a bazooka, or why have a Lamborghini in the garage if you're not going to use it? I mean, that, buying a Lamborghini and keeping it in the garage, rather. But then, I felt like I was not looking at the opportunity set critically. And I said, what really would we be paying for? What would that additional $100,000 each year or so, I think it's a little bit more than that, what would we be buying for that? And then I thought, okay, our staff is really young. They've been playing defense. They, by all purposes for our history and what current state of affairs, they were prohibited from looking at private. So, when you think about aligning with an investment consultant on the private, you have to think about how our staff is going to be educated. What access is it? What is the process of ODD, QDDs, the due diligence process in general? Like, who has, and staff can speak about that for a couple of words, about what their experience is and what they believe the ODD, QDD process was with each investment consultant. But I do think educating our staff in the next year, 18 months, 2 years, is critical when we go into privates, which are always more riskier than our liquid side. So that's my first one. The second one was access. Access. Clearly, Alburn has much greater access. But what they expressed was we would have access to managers we wouldn't normally have because of our size and the size of our allocation. $100 million, while it sounds a lot, is not a lot in the private equity world. And so we would be allocating in a diversified portfolio small tickets. They were very clear to say that because they go into a manager with a collective allocators, that we would be able to benefit from that. That goes without saying that they are very effective in bringing down fees because they come in with such big allocations to managers. And then there's the issue of information. Everybody knows, not everybody knows, but the Castle is incredible. It is a database. It has research. It has information that goes beyond the privates that we could potentially leverage for our more liquid side. And that in itself is a good purchase for information. And in that Castle is also a lot of ODD and QDD reports that we could look at critically in creating process going forward. And then this last part is not really, shouldn't be that important, but I kind of threw it out there in the end, is that choosing Alborn may signal to the investment community that we're just not always going to go with the boutique economical choice, but that we're looking for the best for our situation. And or in any situation where we're looking at with outside service providers. And so I just think that the conversation was geared too much about money and about, too much robust or whatever, or or not knowing our situation, but should be really viewed in a different way. And as far as education access or all of these other things, I need to be convinced that Auburn isn't a better choice in that respect. So I've kind of done it. Let me just say, I do believe either choice would be a great choice. One's proven, one's not proven, but just has the potential. So I'm just throwing it there that I have really been thinking about this very critically and in a different light.
Yeah, we want to hear from anyone that has a thought. I think maybe let's prioritize people who were on the committee first, and include Tom, you speaking up if you want to. Anyone on the committee want to speak their views or minds, and then let's have, you know, conversations amongst all of us.
Trump, yes. Start off with some comments. For full disclosure, I've used both firms in the past. Used Allborn, used Makeda, the real estate side of Makeda as well. They're both tremendous firms, and I'll start with my conclusion. I think a combination of the two would be where I would definitely encourage the board to consider. And I say this for several reasons. One, all the comments that Tina brought out, but also it is an extension of staff. If the pacing is in fact from 6 months to a year down the road, that fee thing is not as consequential, because we're talking a delay before the clock even starts with an Auburn. I don't think there's many comparisons, I can't think of any, that can match up against an Auburn with respect to ODD or due diligence. They have an extensive database. The Castle is a tremendous resource for staff, and it is an excellent opportunity to extend the capabilities of our staff, not only from a learning standpoint, but also state-of-the-art. And it goes beyond just the private side. It also includes and encompasses the industry, litigation, government affairs, these kind of things, which is a perspective that you really need to know and be aware of in the current investment world. As far as size, I think Auburn brings a lot more size and capability to the issue on privates, whatever they may be, as the board gets more actively involved in that space. And finally, as far as the terms and so forth, these are always constantly being negotiated, and that's a question for the board to be comfortable with as we go down that road. But my recommendation would be to take the best of both worlds at this point in time.
Anyone else on the committee want to say anything?
I think the purpose of the investment committee was to bring professionals within different areas within the investment space, and I think it's very powerful that a third of that committee has had experience with both of these entities, and that same third is also a proponent of working with Auburn because of the robustness, because of the resources, because of their personal experience, and their ability to compare the difference between the two, those board members said Auburn is far superior in the area that we are looking to contract. And so for me, it is, even though that we don't know what the private equity investment portfolio is going to look like, I think we start off number one with the best that we can get for a number of reasons. One, I think it is our fiduciary responsibility to the pensioners, and B, it was the area that was problematic for this fund that has created the trauma that we are currently trying to manage. So I think the cost differentiation will be made up in the type of investments that Auburn can get us into, precisely because of their resources, their ability to negotiate fees that a small fund like us can't get if we're looking to get into investments that they have access to, just by the sheer nature of, you know, who they work with and the collective approach in negotiating on behalf of smaller clients like us. So to me, it was very convincing to start with a very strong entity whose space this is their specialty. They're not responding to a need that a client has. This is their space. If you want to contract them in this space, this is what they do best. So that to me is, I'm a proponent of using Auburn and keeping Makita. Obviously, we've already voted on them as a general consultant. But I just think it would, for the reasons that I've just stated, I think it would be best for the plant.
Who is the other person who's worked with
I think Ryan Bailey.
Ryan Bailey, Jamel, and Tom.
Okay. And then that my understanding is that out of the committee, there was sort of a
mixed. Yeah, it was pretty split at the committee.
Okay. So there's not a committee doesn't have a formal.
No, it was kind of.
And we took this up at the IAC as well,
yeah.
And it was a sort of a rehash, and there was a. You know, on one side was when we're going to be starting slow, so let's get something simple like Makita. On the other side was what Tom and Nancy indicated. I mean, I think the more I heard personally, the more I sort of think the Alborn solution is the best guy out there that does the best due diligence, can get us access, get us lower cost. And it seems like, given that was the problem area that we dealt with,
yeah.
We're better off to do something like that. But there were, I think Tina even at that point was saying, well, we're not going to be that complicated. And I think Rakesh was in that camp as well. And I'm trying to think who else. So there was a split.
Yeah, okay.
This is when we vote, there'll be a split as well.
We haven't had one of these in a while. Okay, who else has thoughts you want to share?
Well, I was on a committee, and I agree that Auburn is primo. It's the best out there for private equity, but we're not Calvert size where we're going to be investing $4.5 billion in private equity. We're low, and we're probably the lowest funding pension fund that Albert's going to have to deal with. And I'm just curious as to, is it going to be worth the extra money to pay for whatever they're going to put us in? I think it's going to be a no-brainer that both will probably put us in secondaries. And are we going to get that much more value from Auburn investing in their secondary versus McKee's secondary? And secondly, I mean, we've got 2025 coming up. We already have the actuarial study, you know, being approved by the PRB for our fund. And I'm just afraid of spending money before 2025. I mean, granted, I like what Bill said last week about showing that, you know, we have saved money over the years, but I think that's just, you know, our fiduciary responsibility, and I would rather go to the legislature and say, hey, look, we saved a lot of money. This is what we did as a board, but we still need help.
Just, Kelly, do you have those numbers? We talked about at the meeting just
yes.
The fact that we spend money, but we've been cutting our expenses dramatically over the last 5 or 6 years.
I do. I asked Brenda to prepare those. So she's got that information.
So if we look at our total expenses from 2016 through 2022, professional investment administrative, including investment fees, overall there's been a decline of 48.7% in expenses for that time period.
And what is that in dollars? That's going to be a big number.
Almost $18 million.
Did you say 48%? So what was it in 16? It was 18 million?
18, it was $36.7 million.
Wow.
And for 2022, we're just under 19.
But that includes legal, right? I mean, I think you've done wrong.
Yeah.
I think you want to look at it. I hate to be like a adjusted EBITDA guy, but I think you need to do that in this case.
John, would you pull up the chart, that chart I gave you? So this chart is looking at administrative, so again, that same time period, 2016, but including the 2023 budget. So administrative, investment, which includes management fees that are paid directly, and then investment fund are management fees that are paid through the fund, and then professionals. And you can see for, you know, most of these categories, the trend is very sharply down from 2016 to 2022.
Is that investments and then investment funds? I'm just
right.
What's the distinction there?
Investment fund is management fees that are paid through the fund.
Okay.
And investment fees that we pay directly are included in investment along with consultant fees, the legal fees, you know, investment, those other.
But not legal fees with our, involved with our
private. Only those that relate to investment.
So separate accounts.
Do you want to, Brenda, talk about that number where you just have kind of the consultant piece and the.
Right. So
where
if we,
you've taken the management fees out.
Yeah. So if we look at investment expenses, excluding all management fees, those that are paid both directly and by the funds, over that same time period from 2016 to 2022, it's down almost $2 million, or almost 40%. Now, again, there are legal fees related to investments that are in this number, but over that 2016 to 2022 period, down almost $2 million.
And that would include carry for any partnership, right?
I don't think we have any.
Yeah,
yeah.
There are small amounts to industry ventures and, like, nothing material in the fund.
Yeah, there can be a lot of noise in these numbers, but I think the point holds. I think what Bill's saying is that we have a – and love that, you know, kind of always thinking about that there is enough data points where we have, you know, save money, reduce costs, and all that kind of stuff.
Can I say something?
Yep.
What would justify an increase of fees? A very complicated or potentially riskier investment. I mean, again, I feel like if we're just focusing on fees, I guess that's important. It's in the, you know, that's what you talk about always with investments. But again, if you start looking at educating our existing staff and having that runway to be able to do due diligence on their own, that's going to cost. And I get a little bit concerned when we just talk about, like, reducing fees. We had an existing mess of a portfolio. We should have reduced fees. Going forward, as we look toward the investing and proactively trying to make this fund healthier, what would justify an increase of fees?
From my perspective, it's access to the best managers. It's superior due diligence to avoid pitfalls that we've experienced. So, I mean, those are the other than the cost. It's just to make sure we maximize the opportunities that we have as a fund.
Exactly.
To go into.
Agreed.
Yeah. What other thoughts?
I was going to say, I've dealt with Warren when I was at private equity firm R that I worked with, and I definitely found them to be incredibly thorough. Tom mentioned respect to their ODD that they do on firms. It's incredibly thorough and top-notch, and even working at Garcia Hamilton, we deal with all Warren, and they sent us through a great gauntlet to get assets from a client. So I'm definitely a fan.
Another way to look at Tina's point in terms of fees and such would be to think about what would it cost to hire a professional employee today for the fund, and look at all the additional costs that would be associated with that in terms of benefits and the like. Essentially, the point I made in terms of it is an extension of staff. You're bringing on a consultant, but really that consultant cost is comparable to what it would cost you to add another employee in the process.
Earlier in the conversation, Nick, you brought up sitting here a year from now, what do you need? And it brings us right back to this conversation, that's where I'm leaning. And Ryan made it red. And being the fire trustee, I have to.
Because you're the fire trustee.
Red? I mean, basic.
Red. Put Ken on the other side.
What other comments does anyone have?
I have a little bit of a different view. So for my day job, you know, we have LPs that are like Dallas Police and Fire, and we work with both of these firms. I don't think that we're going to get much differentiated service from either because of the size that we're at. I think that's just a truth that some people may not want to hear. But I think you can't go wrong with either. But I believe that the staff and the team that we have here, plus the board's experience, will get us access to opportunities regardless of who we pick here. And so I think we've got a really good team. I'm not sure how much the decision between either of these two are going to really matter for us, given our check size. But if the investment committee is, you know, not recommending but suggesting that, you know, Auburn is maybe the better play, I think we should defer to them. They've done a lot of the work and a lot of the research. So, yeah, just my opinion.
Okay. Michael,
you want to add? Yeah. My view is, and I bring a bias to the table because, you know, I do something similar to this, and we do the diligence ourselves, so I probably underweight the value just because of my own muscle memory, but I do see the total need in a fiduciary role like this for consultants. I feel probably 60-40 this way, that I would probably wait a year to bring in someone like Auburn and just do Makita, you know, but it's kind of a 60-40. It's not a 90-10 type view. I always worry with my team about the distraction factor whenever there's, like, something that seems kind of new and cool and interesting, that all the energy goes there, and then you kind of forget about, you know, your core, or you minimize running out ground balls in your core. I think that we have a mature, disciplined, yet young team here, but that would be something that, you know, I meet with Ryan every month before the meeting, and I would commit to beat on him hard either way, but just make sure. I do remember, Kelly, you went and did a conference, was it like on valuing businesses or LBOs? Or
it was a private equity class through Columbia.
Yeah, so it does resonate that, like, something like that, that perhaps, you know, research, or there might, I'm sure they have some sort of group, and maybe both firms do, where they have some sort of, you know, online symposium or something where some of those skills. So, you know, I think that one of the things, and to go back to staff, is whichever way we choose, you guys have to be value-added consumers of their services. So if we do go Auburn, I mean, you know, we can all think of things that we've purchased that we don't fully utilize in our own personal lives. And I just would, I think you guys have done a really good job utilizing Makita. You've gotten, I think, the best out of them, or maybe you've gotten great value from them. And if we go the joint of the two, then I think that you guys are taking on a responsibility you don't have right now to educate them and to extract value from them while still doing everything else you've been doing as well or better. So that's incumbent on you guys if we go that way. So it's kind of speak now or don't speak again on this issue in terms of it sounds like you guys are kind of open either way. Is that my sense of it?
Yeah. We have a staff recommendation. It is for Makita. It was a very difficult decision, apparently, to come to. We recognize the committee feedback on the capabilities of Auburn and their ODD and the comprehensiveness of what they bring to the table. To us, it came down to, I think there is a real benefit of having one consultant, this one voice that, you know, if we're looking at a year from now, whether we want to refill the safety reserve or put that in the drawdown or commit to private equity, they have that holistic understanding of the portfolio, and they understand kind of what's going on with the funding side and governance. So one thing we talked about is just given the kind of the fee setup and Makita being able to do some stuff with the current contract, is maybe we don't really know what the private market program looks like, and we don't know when we're going to start, and you know if it's going to be nibbling at secondaries, or we're going to get back in one swoop and we're going to have an up and running program. But maybe it would make sense to start with Makita and then reassess down the road once we have more clarity into what the private market program looks like. And then I would just go back to being very open to either group. It's a board decision. You guys need to work with the consultant. So we have a recommendation, but we're
okay.
more than happy to work.
So using kind of the vernacular I used were, in my mind, I was kind of 60-40 on more or less what you're recommending. You say the will of the senior staff is like that? It's not like a 90-10?
No, it is.
It's like a 60-40.
Yeah, we've had a lot of discussions on how to get there.
Josh, is it, I'm asking in the open session, is it plausible to kind of do something that's a non-vote, kind of get a sense of where people are, and then I think we need to go into closed session after we have a sense of where people are because of the one issue, then we go back in open session and hopefully vote on this.
That's absolutely legal to have a straw vote in open session.
Yeah. Okay. So
can someone hear me? This is Mark Malvo.
Okay. Hey, Mark.
Hi, just a quick question so I can get my hands around this. So if I'm hearing correctly, we have a staff recommendation. Am I understanding that the actual board advisory is of a different take? Is there a contradiction here?
I would say based on the investment advisory committee, it's probably 60-40 the opposite direction. I mean, it's not a majority, not unanimous, but I would say, yes, 60-40 for going for Alborn.
Yeah.
I would be the likelihood of the IAC/special subcommittee.
And the subcommittee meeting where we had the interviews was very split. Yes. That's why there wasn't a vote and a recommendation of one to the
right.
board today. So it's been split kind of at every turn.
Okay.
Okay.
So
thank you.
Why don't I do this? Let's do kind of a hand-only straw vote just with people physically here, then we'll tell the people online what the vote was, and then we can get a sense of it. Okay, so the people that would like to do what Bill said, which is hire both firms to play each of their respective roles, raise your hand if you feel like that's the way you want to go.
Mark Malvo's hands up.
Steve Ido's hands up.
Who would like? Okay. All right, so that's eight. And then who would like to follow staff's recommendation and wait a year? Okay. All right, so it looks like that the will of the board is to do the first thing we discussed, which is hire both firms in a straw vote preliminary fashion. We have some considerations that we need to overlay on top of that we need to consider in closed session. So I'd like to go ahead and go into closed session now.